Ovarian cancer is the 8th most common cancer and the 6th most common cause of cancer death affecting women in Australia. In this report, Dr. Norman Swan of ABC Radio's The Health Report talks to a leading cancer researcher from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne and begins by explaining that while outcomes for women with ovarian cancer have improved, the survival rate is only about 5 years, a major reason being that the tumours develop a resistance to chemotherapy and often return aggressively.
At the moment, when the cancer returns, there are really no good guides to decide on which chemotherapy should be used. The disease we're focused on was high-grade serous cancer. It's responsible for about 60 to 70% of the deaths.
So that's the problem. You've treated it with standard chemo first time around, but what do you do second time around?
At the moment, the main guideline for deciding whether to retreat with the chemotherapy that was used initially, which is platinum-based, is the length of time between the last treatment and when the cancer returns. So if the cancer returns, say, after 12 or 18 months, then the patient will be retreated with platinum.
And just as a way of background here, what we're talking about is basically evolution on steroids, that when you give chemotherapy to somebody who's got a rapidly evolving cancer, cancer cells which are naturally resistant to the chemotherapy are preferentially selected, and therefore you have them surviving the chemotherapy. And the theory, presumably, is if 18 months have gone by, it's a bit like antibiotic resistance, the tumour's kind of reverted to its natural form.
Right, exactly. So it's essentially a Darwinian process. If you've got genetic diversity and you've got a strong selection pressure, chemotherapy, then rare events will become clinically significant. So in one of the patients who actually died and kindly donated her body for a rapid autopsy, we found that...
A rapid autopsy?
A rapid autopsy.
So what's that?
So this is a research-driven autopsy. So it's a full autopsy of the patient, but done for research purposes. The study is called CASCADE, which stands for Cancer Tissue Collection After Death. And it's only established in Melbourne at the moment. It's been an amazing partnership with Tobin Brothers and the Coroner's Office.
The funeral parlour.
The funeral parlour, Tobin Brothers, and Victorian Institute for Forensic Medicine have been amazing partners in establishing this. It's, as far as I know, the only such model in the world. We recruit patients at a couple of clinical centres at the moment while they're alive with their families. It's a very considered discussion between the patient, the family and the clinicians. And then we follow them through their care team, not through the patients or the family, but through their care team as they move in and out of different care situations as their disease progresses. And when they die, Tobin Brothers collects the patient with the permission of the family, and the patient is taken to the coroner's office, who have an incredible sort of skill at performing autopsies on patients. And then Tobin Brothers takes the patient back to the family's funeral home of choice. Patients have died over an area of actually 300 kilometres over Melbourne, and we've been able to collect them and bring them back for rapid autopsy within 5 hours. And so the cells have been intact. We've been able to get high quality DNA out to do the sequencing studies, and we've in fact been able to grow cells out for laboratory studies so that if we find things in the sequencing, we can now test their functionality in laboratory models. You know, I feel very proud of what the team Fantastic. Has achieved. You know, about 80,000 women a year die of this particular type of ovarian cancer around the world. And we know that the cancer evolves on treatment, but no one had actually had the opportunity to look at the cancer that they die of. So we really wanted to know what had changed in the cancer that made it resistant to treatment and actually killed the patient.
And what were you looking at?
This particular patient had been born with a mutation in a gene called BRCA2.
The breast cancer gene, but it also causes ovarian cancer.
Exactly. BRCA2 is part of a beautiful little machine that repairs DNA in a very precise way. And along with BRCA1, they form very important components of that machine. And when they're damaged, that machine doesn't work anymore. And that led to this woman developing ovarian cancer. Now, the sort of the silver lining of having one of those mutations is that it makes the cancer very susceptible to certain types of chemotherapy, particularly platinum salts. That's because it causes the type of DNA damage that these cells are specifically defective for. So what that means is that any cell within that cancer that can restore the ability to repair DNA in that way has a huge selective advantage compared to the other cancer cells. So in this patient, when she died and we collected her samples, we found that the original mutation was present in the cancer, But on 15 separate occasions around her body, the cancer had evolved a second mutation right near the first one that restored what's known as the reading frame of BRCA2 and allowed it now to repair DNA. So
isn't that a good thing?
It was a good thing for the cancer cells. It's not a good thing for the patient. And so to put that into context, if you wrote out our genome in 7-point font, it would cover the floor of the MCG. That's how much code is in every one of our cells. And in her, she had a 5-letter deletion in her BRCA2 gene.
Leaves of grass.
Yeah, just tiny. You wouldn't even see it from the boundary.
And it happened 15 times in her body.
Well, what happened 15 times was right next to that 5-base pair deletion was another deletion that made sense of the code again. So think of our genome like a book. And every page is enough to make a protein. In us, the book's 22,000 pages long. We've got about 22,000 proteins. On one page, BRCA2, there was a 5-base deletion. Now, if we were reading a page and we saw a word was missing 5 letters, we'd just skip the word and keep going and the rest of the page would make sense. In the case of a cell, it can't do that. And it sees everything downstream from that little deletion as being out of frame. So suddenly the text is now gobbledygook.
You've scrambled the egg.
It's scrambled. And so what had happened was that another mutation had occurred that pushed it back into frame. So it made sense again to the cancer cell. It could now make this key protein that was part of this molecular machine. It could now repair the DNA damage caused by the chemotherapy, and it could resist the therapy.
Did it give an indication of, if you'd known that at the time, that would have found a chemotherapy that would have actually worked on this woman?
I'm not sure that we would have known to have found a better chemotherapy, but it would have given us an indication that there was no point in retreating with platinum. There was no point in treating this patient with a PARP inhibitor, which is another way of treating this particular type of mutation. And in fact, in her clinical record, we could see that she had no response at all to those drugs in the relapse setting, although she'd responded very well initially to treatment. So that was one mechanism. In another case, we saw a completely different mechanism. We saw the capture of the on-off switch of one gene by another gene, and the gene that had captured this on-off switch is involved in pumping chemotherapy out of the cell. And so it kind of hotwired the process of being able to push the chemotherapy back out of the cell.
So as soon as the drug came in, it was shoved out.
Yeah. Exactly.
What are the clinical implications of this?
Well, I think there are several things. I think for the longest of time, we've been using these drugs and really not knowing what's occurring in the patient. Now we're starting to systematically map the ways in which the cancer can evade these drugs. And essentially, knowledge is power.
Does this mean then, and I always ask this question in this kind of interview, and I'm told different things by different people, that if you've got ovarian cancer or any cancer, you should have the tumour mapped. And if you've got a secondary cancer, you should insist on that being biopsied and it being mapped so that they know whether or not there's something there that they can treat that's a surprise. And when I say it to oncologists, they throw up their arms in horror and say, no, not on your Nelly. If I say it to an American oncologist, they say, yes, absolutely, I'd hold a gun to your head to actually have it done. And I suspect, David, if somebody in your family tragically were to be involved in one of these cancers, you'd be out there doing their genomics.
Yeah, we'd sequence it for sure. I think the reason you get a mixed answer is that it depends on the cancer. So it's standard of care to do this in non-small cell lung cancer or in melanoma. You must.
Because there are drugs which target specific genetic defects.
Exactly. There are drugs that are very clearly defined for the kinds of mutations that we would expect to see in those patients.
But sometimes you get surprises and you find a mutation which another drug, which is common or garden, cheap off the shelf, can actually attack that mutation. That's not just the fancy new $60,000 a year drug.
There's a wonderful saying, I think it was William Gibson once said, that the future's here, it's just not evenly distributed. And that's absolutely the case for cancer medicine at the moment. There are centres that have the capacity that are making this now standard of care. There are cancers for which it's extremely appropriate. For other cancers where we're still doing the discovery work, where we need to do the things that are, for example, in our study, to map the mutations, to be able to say to patients, okay, we now have a catalogue of these things. We now understand what they do. This is now part of our standard practice in how we treat you.
So what you're saying with ovarian cancer is you're not ready for showtime yet because you still don't know the full range and what you can actually do about it.
I think we're getting close. One of the mutations, the one involving the pump, I think that suggests a clinical trial, actually. There are drugs that inhibit that pump. I think it's clear that in about 10% of women with this type of recurrent ovarian cancer, we're seeing that pump activated. I want to particularly mention the Royal Women's Hospital in Parkville. They've been absolutely amazing partners as well. And it's without that sort of clinical linkage that none of this could happen. We also worked extremely closely with Westmead Hospital, Dr. Anna DeFazio, and the sequencing was a partnership with the Institute for Molecular Bioscience, Sean Grimmins' group in Queensland.
In that ABC Radio National interview, first broadcast in June 2015, Professor David Botell pointed out that helping to ensure the success of the Cascade program is what he called the amazing partnership with Tobin Brothers Funerals and the Coroner's Office. Tobin Brothers Manager of Operations, David Stevens.
The relationship between Tobin Brothers and Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre has been an ongoing relationship over many years, and indeed, more particularly, our relationship with the Institute of Forensic Medicine is a very strong one. And as a result of a discussion between those two organisations, our relationship with them both saw them approach us to see if we could assist in transferring deceased in this program. They had no idea how to go about getting these transfers done for them out of ours, and they wanted to look at the practicality of a funeral company obviously giving them some assistance. And given the nature of the program, the relationship between all of the organisations, the wonderful objectives to find and to continue to research cure for cancer meant that we were more than happy to help and assist. We saw that it wasn't a large number of transfers that were being identified over the ensuing months, and as a result of that, we felt that we could provide them with that assistance, and we did, and we have done for the last 12 months. It's been terrific.
What should we understand when we hear the term rapid autopsy?
Rapid autopsy is a term used by the research people to get access to an autopsy process in a far quicker way than what would ordinarily occur. Ordinarily, the autopsy is done be they at a hospital or research organisation, or indeed in many occasions with the coroner's office, are carried out a number of days after death. What the research program were needing were to get authority of the deceased with their full knowledge in the lead up to signing on to the program, that they were able to transfer from the place of death to the Institute of Forensic Medicine and have an autopsy done within, I believe it's about a 4-hour time frame. And that's what we target, that's what we aim to do. We are given advice of people that come onto the program by Peter MacCallum, and we are made aware of that. We don't necessarily have to do anything until such time as they then give us a call and let us know that the person's passed away. They've pre-arranged with the treating medical practitioners the documentation that's required, the medical certificate concerning death that is issued in such cases. And all we need to do is just get to the place of death and transfer the deceased into the Institute. And we've done that now on I think, about 30 occasions over the last 12 to 18 months.
Tobin Brothers Funerals Manager of Operations, David Stevens. And that concludes this podcast, which has been looking at aggressive cancers and rapid autopsies. I'm Michael Lynch for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.